Okay, so we have our panel here, a very interesting and diverse group, but focused on a set of key resources. So the floor is open to questions. Here we go.
My name's Paul Wilson, I'm from the University, not from the UK. Particularly a question about precision agriculture. We've heard a lot about fertilizer, water, and technology, really. And it strikes me that there is opportunities there to improve food production around the world, but it's not necessarily a sexy area for researchers to get involved in. So I'm just wondering how we can incentivize people to get involved in that area much more to make some big gains.
I'll start then. I'm going to add some things too on the fertilizer front. I think one of the things that is going to become sexy because of the high increases in energy prices, as well as the fact that crop prices are making it more beneficial to do better input practices as well. I mean, we're seeing now actually this spreading rapidly. Laser land leveling is now booming in the Punjab in India, for example, in just the last 3 years. And it needs, I think, both the private sector and some public sector funding initially to get these kinds of things moving. But they're already moving to an area where it's mostly private contracting of the laser land leveling. And I think from there they're going to move much more towards some of the precision planting and fertilizer application and so forth. Conservation tillage itself has also spread rapidly through many developing countries, directly due, in fact, to fertilizer price increases of a few years ago. So I think it is being incentivized, but it is still lacking, I think, in the public sector to get some of the fundamental technologies developed.
Yeah, just to follow up with what Mark has said, you know, the price of fertilizer is the driving factor. And many of the countries are beginning to use it, but mainly for the high-value crops. One of the areas, the drip irrigation, water, and nutrient, it is, first of all, the investment is high, and second of all, the product that is needed to make that effective is much more expensive than the conventional fertilizer, because these are very specialty products. Investment is a big area, and right now, we see many of the countries, as Mark mentioned, they are beginning to use it, particularly driven by the water issue as well as the energy prices. I think these are two driving factors.
And I think if we looked at just water, for example, much of that technology is already well known and understood. I think it's really a policy resourcing decision that needs to move forward. For example, if we looked at Pakistan, it has a similar climatic growing area as Southern California. And if we could generate the productive capacity in Pakistan that we can in Southern California, and there's no reason not to with efficient irrigation and precision farming, there would be very little need for that country to look at expansion of new water resource projects. They could meet their food requirements with simply rejigging the programs and the water programs that they already have.
Any other question over here?
Yes, Jean-Marcel Laferrière from CBEC. How do you see the improvement of productivity of agriculture in Africa? And do you think that the foreign investment will contribute to this improvement in productivity? By what you are saying, it seems that a lot of the investment is coming from local people. It means that there is resources available, and if we come to the improve technology, it should contribute to improving productivity.
Was it Africa, you said?
Yeah, in
Africa, yeah, there really is a lot of potential there. That if you look at the numbers, the yields there are only about half of what they should be, even given the tougher situations in Africa. But a number of hurdles have to be overcome. One is the extremely poor infrastructure that makes it so that inputs to African farmers are cost double or more of what they would, say, even to an Indian farmer, and also makes it so they get very low prices for their outputs. Another is adapting the technology to local climates. That the advantage in the Asian Green Revolution was fairly large-scale ecosystems that could be planted to the same varieties, whereas in Africa you need to tailor them to much more diverse climates and harsher areas. There's finally some, I think, some good work being done that brings in good genetic technologies from the public sector and also private sector, and is working to adapt it to those local ones. So that's going to be absolutely necessary. As well, as you're pointing out, they have to start listening better to the farmers and find out what are the constraints to them to plant new varieties rather than going for just the top-down approaches. So I think there's a lot of potential, but also a lot of work that needs to be done there.
Okay, so we have questions over here.
Just on this question of African productivity and technology transfer, I think with existing technology, you often see stories about yield gaps, you know, the gap to the efficiency frontier in field trials being 30% or more. There's obviously a lot of scope there. In terms of whether foreign investment can help, I think it depends very much on the particular business model that foreign investment brings with it. And so the large-scale land acquisitions where sometimes we're having production based on industrial-type activities, perhaps the transfer possibilities are more limited. But we're doing a lot of work trying to encourage a shift towards alternative business models based on things like nucleus outgrower schemes and so on, which probably have greater potential for technology transfer.
I work for Oxfam and Quebec, and the report mentioned on the graphs that is actually available. We have a table outside, and we have a food security and cultural campaign, and anyway, here I want to have the report is outside. And in the report, there are several case studies on land graphs, including one from Uganda and another from Honduras and others. My first question is for Mr. Rosengren, and it's regarding what is your position on, or if you can comment on the what is being discussed at the G20 regarding the elimination of mandates for biofuels. If you can comment on that. And then my second question is to Mr. Patterson. All this technology and improvement that have been going on in Alberta, how is this benefiting, and I know there are no women in Alberta, but it's more farmers in Alberta. And are you reaching at all, is within the work that you're doing, any work with developing countries to share these technologies?
Yeah. Our position from our research is that the biofuel mandates should all be eliminated, subsidies should be removed, and trade barriers protecting the industry should be removed. But I would point out that that's not going to choke. That won't choke off the industry. It will slow it down. But as long as oil stays say $90 per barrel and above, you will still get some production and probably some growth in production, but not nearly the rate which it's what you see now.
In terms of Alberta's impact on some of the developing countries, I would say that in the 70s and 80s and perhaps early 90s, there was a lot of work going on by Alberta institutions, including our own department, and many of the developing countries, and I've been to a few of them. But I would say that there has been a change over the last 10 or 15 years away from water development kinds of projects into some of the other areas. And my feeling would be that as we move into the future, Canada and the United States and other developed countries have some tremendous opportunities in terms of water development programs that should be considered, again, I think, as part of the key aid program to programming as we move forward.
So maybe take one over here.
My name is Douglas Headley. I want to congratulate the organizers for such a wonderful panel. concern that you expressed on foreign direct investment is primarily about land in the developing world. Are there parallels on the purchase of other natural resources, including the fossil fuels, the precious metals, the base metals, forestry, that are also going on, and does that lead us to any conclusions about how to handle land purchases in the third world?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, our work on foreign investment and land acquisitions, it began actually by looking at biofuel investments. But then if you go back, you'll see there's actually quite a long history of concerns about foreign investment in things like the extractive industries, minerals, and so on. And there is a thing called the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, which is something a little bit similar to what we are proposing for agricultural investments, which monitors the extent and impacts of these investments, impacts on the environment, on local stakeholders, and so on. So there is a history there, and some of that work is instructive from the point of view of looking at the question of the so-called land grabbing as well.
I want to make a comment related to fertilizer. I think it's an important example. I mentioned today globally you have about 500 million tons of fertilizer that are used. And out of that, about 40% is traded internationally. Many of the countries don't have the resources, but they have joint ventures being set up in different countries to extract, get phosphorus, for example. And there is a drive and there's an initiative and discussion that is going on, given the finite nature of these of phosphorus, should there be controlled by a governing body, a world governing body, in terms of making sure that every country has access to it. A case in point is India. It's the second largest user of agricultural fertilizer in the world. It has only 3% of its indigenous resources of phosphate. The rest of it is all imported all over the world, including Africa, Australia, and other places. So you do have examples where you're doing this kind of thing.
Given the time constraints, I'm just going to take one more question over here. And if you are still with questions, you can ask the speaker.
Thank you. Fabienne Closer from CETA. I'm the CETA officer who's responsible for the Canadian International Food Security Research Fund. One of the key aspects of the fund is that it acknowledges the role of women as key agents in our efforts globally to improve food security. And I just wanted to ask the speakers for some reflections on some of the lessons they've learned through their different research areas and their reflections on the implications on women, particularly women as being small-scale farmers, such a big part of the population. Yeah, just your thoughts on that.
We're doing a lot of work on the role of women in agriculture at IFRI. It's focusing very much now on how do you build assets for women in not only in farming but in the rural sector as well to further empower them. And we're looking very specifically at how new technologies and new drivers in the world, such as climate change, affect the role of women in agriculture, and to what extent they are affected more or less than men, and if there are special adaptive policies that should be put in place as well. So it's a very major program of work we have, and I'd be glad to talk with you more as well.
Yeah, could I just add, the question of women and gender issues is addressed in this year's FAO State of Food and Agriculture. This is one of our flagship publications for those of you who are not familiar with it. And this is a comprehensive review about the role of women, the policies involved. And I think it's worth highlighting well, obviously everybody knows about the important role of women as small farmers, especially in Africa, but I think it's perhaps less well known that it's typically women who suffer front of the adverse effects of price volatility and high food prices more than male-headed households. And also, even going back to the other theme this morning, in things like land acquisitions and so on, the rights of women to land holding and so on are much weaker and tend to be more abused than for men.
Okay, I think that's it for now. It's been an interesting discussion. We've looked at a number of key resources, water, fertilizers, land, energy, genetics, balance of biology, and even investment. And the very complicated relationships that can exist among those and how they affect food prices and food security. So it's been an interesting session. And I want to thank our speakers who are looking to join me in thanking our speakers.